thank you to the organizers for inviting me to come. As Vito said, I've been here several times. I always enjoy coming. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's always a challenge to decide what to talk about, because I want to talk about something that we are struggling with in the clinic at a particular point in time that might actually benefit from input from folks like you, who have an understanding of the mathematical underpinnings of modeling that could support the sorts of clinical problems that we're dealing with. And I've talked about different things over the years, but I think one of the things we're struggling with now and will continue to struggle with is how we image in patients, or for that matter in preclinical tumor models, growing in animals, for example, response to treatment. And I'll talk a bit about what I mean by that. First of all, as you heard, I'm a radiation oncologist. I'm not a medical imager, so I'm not a diagnostic radiologist. I'm not that interested in imaging as a means of diagnosing cancer, of distinguishing a normal tissue from a tumor, from a malignant tissue. I'm much more interested in knowing, using imaging, how this particular patient with cancer is going to respond to my treatment, how he or she is likely to do down the road after we've completed treatment, and also, can we interrogate the tumor while we're giving the treatment to sort of modify our treatment as we go along so that we're not stuck with one plan right up front. And most of what I think about is radiation oncology, and these days there's a lot of work, a lot of research, and a lot of clinical translation going on in terms of improving radiation response for people. First of all, about 50% of patients with cancer should get radiation treatment at some point during the course of their illness. So it's a big problem, and there's a huge potential there to improve outcome if we can actually focus on some of the issues that are impeding our ability to control these cancers in patients. There's two real ways that people are looking at this right now in the cancer community in general and in radiation oncology, and these are illustrated here. One of them is to say, can we actually deliver radiation more precisely to a tumor? Can we deliver higher doses to the cancer and keep the radiation away from all of the normal tissues around there that contribute to side effects? And that's illustrated on the left. And this is something that is technology-driven and is really moving forward at an accelerated pace right now. The other approach is to say, well, okay, that's one strategy, but can we also better understand the biology of these cancers? Can we understand why they develop and grow in particular ways, why they differ in their aggressiveness, why some metastasize and others don't metastasize, and why they respond differently to treatments? And then can we go about modulating that effect in some way, or adding different treatments in combination with radiation to improve outcome? And what really links these two, there are many things that really link them, but one of the most important things, I think, is the imaging element, because we have to be able to image the tumor precisely if we want to target anatomically, and we have to be able to interrogate these tumors at a biologic level if we want to understand what's really happening in them. So this kind of brings the two together. And there are many reasons that we might want to image these tumors in relation to outcome. I'm going to talk most today about MR imaging, magnetic resonance imaging in these tumors, and also positron emission tomography, which I think is an exciting area that requires development, and there's opportunities there for development of new models and input from your community to help us. But what we're interested in is outcome prediction. Can I actually get information from imaging before I start treatment that tells me how that patient's going to do after treatment? And unique information, not the same kind of stuff I can get from just examining the patient, doing a thorough clinical exam and talking to him or her. Can I use that imaging information that I get before treatment or during treatment by repeat imaging to actually change my treatment plan or adapt the treatment in some way so that that patient does better than he or she would have otherwise? And that can be anatomic information, just simply information about size and shape of the cancer, position of the cancer, or it can also be biologic information, something inherent in the function of that cancer. There are people working on radiation dose escalation, so you image a tumor, you image some biologic aspect of the tumor that you think is associated with radiation resistance, and you deliver a higher dose of radiation to that region of the tumor that has, you think, radio-resistant cells. And then the other really interesting area is, can we use imaging to give us to look at earlier endpoints in the context of clinical trials? So if we do a clinical study where we add a drug with radiation, do we have to wait 2 or 3 or 4 years down the road to get the results of that study, or can we get surrogate endpoints at earlier times by looking at some imaging measure of biology, for example, or early response? And I'll talk about some of these as I go along. Most of what I'm going to focus on is cervical cancer, because I treat cervical cancer, and that's where I spend a lot of time thinking. about these sorts of problems. This is an MR image. This is a sagittal image and an axial image in a patient. This is a large cervical tumor here, situated in the cervix with rectum behind and bladder down here. These tumors can be quite aggressive. They affect women of all ages, really, and they're life-threatening sometimes, but they're also curable with radiation. So it's a great population to look at and study. They also spread in semi-predictable ways, and this is a woman who has lymph node metastases along the pelvic sidewalls, this mass here. What I'm going to talk about is cervical cancer today, but I think most of the concepts apply across the board and to many types of cancers that are out there right now. So the first thing that you can look at when in relation to MR imaging is just what happens to the tumor as you treat them. First of all, we know information about tumor size from imaging before we begin treatment, and we know that's a very important predictor of cancer outcome. Women who have bigger cancers, bigger cervical cancers, do worse than women who have smaller tumors, and women who have lymph node metastases do worse than those who don't. But you can also get useful information about how these cancers change over time by imaging them repeatedly during treatment. And this is an area that's evolving right now and provides some information that you can use to tailor treatment as you go along. And that's really the focus of another talk. But inherent in this kind of response during treatment are biologic issues that actually influence this. What's going on inside these cancers when you deliver radiation treatment? Why are they regressing? Why do some regress at different rates than others? Why are some patients cured? Why are some patients not cured? The same size, the same dose, the same everything, but there are inherent differences. And this, I think, represents biologic heterogeneity within these cancers. So the kinds of things that we've been most interested, or I've been most interested in looking at over the years, relate to aspects of the tumor microenvironment. So cancers can be thought of as having various compartments in very simplistic ways. There's a vascular compartment, there's an interstitial compartment, which contains all the sorts of stuff around the cancer cells and the blood vessels, and then there's the cellular compartment, which contains the cancer cells themselves. And all of these three compartments interact in a very dynamic way to actually influence patient outcome over time and response to treatment over time. What we've been mostly focusing on in our work is the vascular compartment, which is depicted in this image here, the abnormal blood vessels and tumors. And these vascular effects integrated with the cellular compartment, which is also integrated here, actually lead to a whole bunch of measurable abnormalities in the microenvironment or in the interstitium of these cancers. And three of these are illustrated right here. One of them is hypoxia or low oxygen levels. This has probably been most extensively studied in solid cancers at both a preclinical level and a clinical level, and Dick has done an awful lot of work in that area over the years. Low pH or acidosis is another manifestation, and high interstitial fluid pressure is a third one. And these are all coupled or linked to the vasculature in different ways. And that is something, those sort of interactions, I'm not going to talk about in detail today. But I am going to focus mostly on aspects of the vasculature that influence these three, and then also imaging of hypoxia itself. So this is just to remind everybody about the differences in blood vessels and tumors and the sort of a driver for many of these abnormalities. In fact, the blood vessels develop in conjunction or in concert with other abnormalities within the microenvironment. So it's not that one explicitly drives the other. It's much more of a integrated development over time. But in normal tissues, the vessels are very well organized and very efficient at delivering nutrients like oxygen to the tumors or carrying away waste products. Whereas in tumors, this is not atypical. You get a very disorganized, chaotic pattern of vasculature within the tumors. And blood flow is chaotic within that network, and delivery of oxygen and nutrients is very disorganized. So it's possible, for example, to have some tumors where blood flow is actually quite low, and those tumors can be hypoxic because they're not getting oxygen. You can also have tumors where blood flow is measured. If you measure blood flow, it's actually quite high, and those tumors can still be hypoxic because of the nature of the vasculature and the fact that the oxygen that's being delivered or the flow through that tumor is largely with deoxygenated blood, and it's not delivering anything useful to the cancer cells. The other thing, of course, that figures into the mix is the consumption of oxygen by cancer cells, which can be quite variable from tumor to tumor. And over the years, there's been a lot of work done looking at these various aspects, and we continue to look at tumor biopsies as a way of getting information about the vasculature and hypoxia within tumors. And this is a section of a tumor. I don't think this is a human tumor. It might have been a head and neck tumor, actually, where you can see these blood vessels stained in red here, and the green is staining for hypoxia with a particular drug that was given to this patient and is bound in hypoxic areas. And you can get very useful information about how these characteristics interact and how this might predict outcome for patients at a microscopic level. So you see what's going on at a very high resolution within these tumors. There are challenges with this, though. You know, in terms of radiation treatment, a biopsy may or may not represent the picture in the entire tumor. Many, like that cervix cancer I showed you, was 5 or 6 centimeters in size. You might have a 5 millimeter biopsy, and does that actually really represent what's going on in the entire tumor? And does it usefully provide does it provide useful information in relation to outcome? And the second thing is, you can't be biopsying patients repeatedly during treatment. In most cases, they'll let you do it once up front to establish a diagnosis, and maybe a second time. But if you said to them, "I want to do this every week so that I can track what's going on in your tumor," that's probably not going to fly. So we need other ways of dealing with heterogeneity. We need other ways of dealing with repeatability or reproducibility in patients. And in fact, you can't ignore what's going on at a tissue level, and we need to integrate this kind of information with the imaging stuff that I'm going to show you, because it's all very complementary. So the first technique I want to talk about, and I apologize to those who know about this, there's a lot of work been done over the years looking at MR techniques for getting information about tumor vasculature as sort of a core driver of what's happening within these tumors. And most of the techniques, or a couple of the techniques that have been used a lot, are dynamic contrast enhanced DCE, MR, or CT. You can do it with CT scans as well. And the concept here is that you have a patient lying on the treatment couch here, or on the CT or on the MR bed, and you identify a vessel within the field of view, and you identify the tumor within the field of view, and you give the patient a bolus injection of a contrast agent. In many ways, it's meant to simulate a delta function, so it's meant to be a very sharp increase and drop again in terms of this sort of perturbation of the system with some kind of usually low molecular weight radiographic contrast agent that then transits through the vasculature. Usually quite a rapid rise and a decay, not quite a delta function. And then you look at the tumor enhancement. And by taking this information about arterial enhancement, the time activity curves for the arterial phase from the vessel and the time activity curves for the tumor, and plunking those into various models, you can actually come up with parametric maps of distribution of what people think are important biologic parameters within these tumors, and summary statistics that are also useful for comparison across patients. In a study, for example, or across patients that you're seeing in the clinic. And this technique, as I've said, has been used in MR and CT, and I'll spend a bit of time talking about this and some of the limitations that are inherent in this, because we use this in patients, or we have used this in patients with cervical cancer, and as we've used this, we've identified lots and lots of areas that need to be addressed, improved, if we want to actually make this more robust and usable. So this enhancement pattern, which is what we're seeing here, there's a cervical tumor with the rectum back here and the bladder here, and I think this will loop around again. So it enhances very quickly. There it's unenhanced, and you can see this enhancement pattern here as a function of time is influenced by many, many factors after injection of that contrast, including the imaging characteristics themselves, the way in which that contrast is injected, either sort of dribbled in slowly or as a bolus injection. The characteristics of the contrast agent, as I said, most of these studies have been done with low molecular weight agents. There is an intriguing area of research looking at very large molecular weight agents for imaging vasculature in tumors. And again, it's a whole other talk, and I may allude to it a couple more times, but it's just intriguing because it provides other information. But then in addition to all those factors that are sort of methodologically determined, there's a number of factors that are really a function of the tumor itself, such as the vessel distribution and permeability and blood flow and blood volume, transit time, and so on, that actually influence this contrast enhancement pattern. So sorting these things out and teasing out information that's valuable is one of the challenges that we face. And these are some of the uncertainties that arise from that. So in terms of making the measurement, how much contrast, what contrast do we use, how much do we use, and how quickly do we inject it? How quickly do we need to image this after injection to sample this in a reliable way? And understanding that the patient's laying on the couch as this is happening, so you're always trying to be concerned about his or her time and inconvenience and comfort during the whole thing. The patient's not a block of stone, so he or she's going to move around, so you've got motion artifact that's inherent in this, and then just signal-to-noise problems as a result of the imaging modality itself. In terms of analysis, do we analyze what's a relevant volume of interest? How do we optimally contour identify that? Do we do pixel-based analyses? Do we do volume of interest analyses over larger volumes? All of these things are integrated decisions. And then the modeling itself, there are as many ways in the literature right now that people have described the enhancement dynamics for these tumors as there are papers almost. That's not entirely true because there has been some attempt at standardization. But the modeling is variable, it's continuously changing, and there's not a constant for someone who's in the clinic actually looking at these patients, that there's not a constant that someone can say, this is what we should be doing and will provide robust and reproducible results. We got into problems, for example, because we've used different models, also because the measurement technique has changed. So we applied this technique of MR imaging to about 100 patients with cervical cancer over several years. And by the time we reached the end of that, we had new MR equipment, we had new approaches to doing the MR imaging, and so we lost a whole bunch of the patient material from the early phase of that study just because of technique evolution. And so it's a very dynamic and complicated area to be working in. There's also no gold standard. If we define from these models a metric that we think reflects some important aspect of the vasculature, like permeability of the blood vessels, how do we know that really means anything in terms of really what's happening within those tumors? And as I said, there has been some attempt to standardize some of these things, and there are a few papers in the literature, the results of working groups that have come together and said, okay, we really need to nail this down in a way that we can help the clinical community move forward with these kinds of dilemmas. And the first one actually defines sort of standardized parameters and analysis methodologies for looking at DCEMR, and the second is similar but really focused on, can we use these kinds of techniques to really measure the response of anti-angiogenic treatments, which are treatments that specifically target the vasculature in tumors. So I just want to talk a little bit, I didn't put much in the way of modeling in here except to illustrate this to you, the sorts of models that are currently being used. And if we think about what influences contrast agent transport in tumors, whether that's small molecular weight or large molecular weight, there's really two processes. One is convection and one is diffusion. So convection is driven by hydrostatic pressure gradients, either across the vessel wall from the intravascular space to the interstitial space of tumors, or through the interstitium of tumors as a result of pressure gradients within the interstitium itself. The second process is diffusion, which of course in the same way is driven by concentration gradients. And most of the contrast, and generally you can break these things down, small molecular weight agents typically move by diffusion, large molecular weight agents typically move by convection. So as I said earlier, most of the contrast agents that are being used in the clinic are low molecular weight, and you would expect them to move by diffusion, these two components here. But there is a lot of work being done looking at larger molecular weight components, liposomal agents, for example, that would primarily move by convection. So it opens up a whole new area of interest whereby you can, in theory, differentially image with these two types of contrast agents, with a low molecular weight agent first and a high molecular weight agent later, and get information that relates to diffusion and convection separately within these tumors. So it's actually an area that is under development right now. Most of the models, as I'll show you, that have been used to analyze dynamic contrast enhanced MR have ignored the convective component entirely and focused on diffusion within these tumors. And that's interesting. It's probably not an unreasonable assumption in many cancers because convection is much lower. Certainly interstitial convection is much lower because the interstitial fluid pressure is high, which is different from most normal tissues. So these are the kinds of models that have been used, are in place right now. The TOFS model that is derived from this generalized kinetic model is based entirely on diffusive flux from the vascular space to the interstitial space and back again. And in the simplest form, the TOF model has two transfer constants, if you like, K-trans and K-EP. And K-trans, when you solve this equation for specific circumstances, has two interpretations depending on the actual characteristics of the tumor you're dealing with. And you never actually know, in most cases, which situation you're in. But if you, there's two ways that K-trans can be influenced. High K-trans implies that you've got a lot of contrast moving from the vascular space into the interstitial space. And low K-trans, obviously, the other way. If you've got low blood flow in that tumor, so if you've got a situation where you've got a flow limitation, the abnormalities of the vasculature are such that you're just not getting blood or plasma into the region that you're into the tumor, then you have a flow-limited condition, which is illustrated here. But and in that case, K-trans really is proportional to blood flow in the tumor. However, in situations where you have permeability-limited conditions, in which case blood flow is plentiful, you're getting lots of flow into that tumor, K-trans can reflect changes in permeability within the tumor. So when we actually use DCE modeling in patients and get a K-trans measure, what we know, or what we think it's telling us, is something about the vasculature, but we never actually know in any particular circumstance whether we're getting a measure of blood flow, or whether we're getting a measure of vascular permeability, or whether we're getting some combination of the two, which is likely the case for most circumstances. The only thing we do know is that in most tumors, permeability is very high. The blood vessels, as I showed you earlier, are very abnormal and they leak fluid all over the place. So in many situations, and we have some evidence from some of the studies we've done to suggest that K-trans probably is telling us more about blood flow in tumors than it is about permeability, but there's a lot of noise there and we don't know that for sure. That generalized model, kinetic model, the most common ways of approaching that in terms of practical solutions to this that can be used in the clinic are the TOFS model or the modified TOFS model. And these really are based on measuring, not assuming that you know what the arterial input function is, not assuming that it's a step function or a delta function, but actually measuring it in a vessel, as I said earlier, and taking that information and using that to actually determine, and the measured concentration in the tumor, to derive these unknown parameters, K-trans and K-EP. This has been modified also to allow some measure of blood volume or plasma volume, which is probably the second most commonly used model. So two unknowns here, essentially, and three unknowns here. But there are lots of uncertainties still inherent in this. So one of the most important ones in MR is that the signal we measure with MR is not necessarily directly proportional to the concentration of the contrast agent in the vessel or in the tumor. It is with CT, but not with MR. So there is a non-linearity here between what's really going on in the tumor or the vessel and what we're measuring with MR. And the second thing is we need to measure this arterial input function in order to determine the concentration of the contrast agent in the vasculature. And this is challenging with MR because of artifacts associated with the imaging technique itself, and also the problem of finding a suitable vessel within the volume that you're imaging. So if you're imaging something in the belly and you've got the aorta sitting there, that's great. If you're down in the pelvis and you're trying to image a smaller iliac vessel, it can be challenging sometimes just because of signal-to-noise issues in resolution. And of course, the other thing we don't know here is the microvascular hematocrit. Everyone assumes it's about 0.45, but we know that hematocrits are quite different in the microvasculature of tumors compared to large central vessels in the body. So that's another unknown. People usually ignore that one. So we did a bit of work with a group in Chicago, actually, looking at ways of getting these arterial input functions. And this is 38 patients with cervix cancer. And there are a bunch of ways of doing it. One way is that you can measure it. These are now average arterial input functions from our 38 patients. This actually is the same as this, but it just shows it with greater resolution at shorter times here. But if you look at this light blue line, that's the measured function, the arterial input function that was measured, average function, arterial input function that was measured for these patients. And it looks quite different than the others that are on the screen here. The black one here is a technique called the multiple reference tissue method, where the arterial where several reference tissues within the field of interest are identified. The arterial input function for each of those volumes of interest is assumed to have the same shape and only shifted in time as a function of the arrival time of that bolus to the tissue that you're interested in. And then you basically solve for an arterial input function, what's going on in the central vasculature. You solve for a function or the arterial input function that actually best satisfies what you're actually observing in the tissues. So that multiple reference tissue method is shown here, which is quite different from the measure. These are 95% confidence intervals on that one. And the third one that's shown here is a published arterial input function that was derived from many patients using high-resolution sampling. And this is something that is available in the literature. And so there's a lot of difference between these, and presumably which arterial input function you use will influence the results that you get out the other end. And what we did was we had CT data in these patients as well. And as I said earlier, CT is a bit simpler because a lot of the problems associated with getting an arterial input function with CT MR are not present with CT. There's linearity between contrast concentration and the signal, and all of the issues associated with capturing information from a small vessel are a little easier with CT. So in our case here, I mentioned earlier, we don't have a gold standard. We use CT as the gold standard for actually saying what happens when you vary the technique with these arterial input functions. So this basically looks at K-trans here and KEP. Just look at those two because those are the two that are most relevant from the TOFS model. And you can see that there's certainly a correlation between the CT measurement and the measurement obtained with this multiple reference tissue method, but they're not perfect correlations, particularly for K-trans, which is the one that's used most often to provide information about what's going on in these patients. There was, in fact, a systematically lower measurement of K-trans when we used the MR multiple reference tissue method, and also a systematically lower KEP than we found with CT. And that's illustrated in this slide as well. This is the CT measurement, the mean K-trans and KEP across patients. And this is the multiple reference tissue method, systematically lower for both of these, particularly for K-trans. Interestingly, the published AIF yielded results, at least across the whole patient population, that was closer probably to CT. So in many cases, it's a lot simpler simply to use the published AIF. I think it's a compromise. I think this is an area where we need work to actually figure out how we actually gather information about what's going on in the vasculature and use that to inform our models about what's going on in the tumor in relation to permeability and blood flow. Most people now use published AIFs, and that's what we did here when we looked at when we actually calculated these numbers for a bunch of patients with cervix cancer. These are the same 38 as I showed you before, imaged with MR. These are some overlap. This is a group of about 100 patients who had CT, and this is K-trans and KEP. And it compares muscle, which is in blue, so this is normal tissue, and the sort of red color is the tumor values. And you can see that there's a consistent shift within tumors towards higher values of K-trans, consistent with either higher blood flow or higher permeability within those tumors. And similarly with K, and you see that same trend both CT and MR, and similarly with KEP, although it's perhaps not as obvious. So what this says is that these techniques are able to give us information that allows us to distinguish tumors from normal tissues. So they are telling us something valuable. They are reflecting differences in the vasculature between these two types of tissues. It doesn't say anything about whether or not these are telling us anything about patient outcome. Does it matter if we know that tumors or a particular tumor is situated over here rather than down here if we measure that before treatment is administered? And in fact, that's the big question right now because there's not a consistent story in the literature. We have looked at this in relation to our 38 patients that we imaged with MR, and also in relation to those 100 patients or so that had CT. We don't see any linkage to outcome, looking at a pretreatment measurement up front that, of K-trans, for example. And other people have described stuff, but if you look at what's in the literature going back, you know, 10 or more years now, they're all small studies, some as small as 8 patients, which you really can't learn much from. The outcome measures are all over the map. Some people basically describe things like poor response or better regression or clinical response, but nothing that you can really hang your hat on. And the parameters that people have used are all over the map as well. Sometimes they've used KEP or K-trans, which, you know, are the things that we've tried to use from a standardization perspective, but other people have described things like just high permeability, whatever that means, or indices of relative enhancement within the tumor, not doing any modeling at all, just looking at the time activity curves within the tumor. And so this is the most disappointing piece from my mind, to my mind, is that despite a lot of activity, we haven't been able to put this all together in a way that I think optimally informs us about how a particular patient is likely to do based on pretreatment measurements alone. And maybe the reason it doesn't come out is there's nothing here. I mean, we have to accept that. But it just seems to me that because the vasculature is such an important driver of what's going on, that knowing as much as we can about that should in some way translate to knowledge about how the patients are likely to do. There is an interesting study that was reported by Nina Mayer's group in the U.S. in 100 patients. And the difference between this study and the ones I just showed you is that she not only measured before treatment, she also measured, did the same sort of measurement during treatment, midway through treatment, a couple of times during treatment, in fact. And what she found was that the metric she used was not based on any fancy modeling. They just looked at the time enhancement curves on a pixel by, a time enhancement map on a pixel by pixel basis. And took the 10th percentile enhancement value here. And they use a threshold of about 2 times enhancement at baseline. But the key is not that. The key is that what was most important in this study is that it's not just what's happening up front that's important before you start treatment, it's what's happening during treatment that's also important. So here's, if you've got good blood flow and a lot of enhancement early on, the tumors tend to do well. But you can actually start off quite poorly prior to radiation treatment. You actually then do better if that, and if you remain low, you do poorly all the way along. What she found was that second measurement was very important in determining, in separating out these ones that were low initially. So you're either low initially and stay low, in which case you do bad, or you're low initially and improve, in which case you do better. So it may be that what's confounding us with just the pretreatment measurements is that we're not getting enough information about the dynamics and the change in vascular characteristics as treatment progresses, as radiation treatment progresses. And so the concept that these studies may be more useful in terms of looking at response to treatment as a predictor rather than just looking up front is actually something that's emerging. And we did something similar in a study where we used antiangiogenic treatment in our patients with cervix cancer. So these are women who were being treated with curative intent, and they, in addition to standard treatment with radiation and cisplatinum, they also received this drug sorafenib. And then we did a whole bunch of biomarkers actually, but we did DCEMR and DCECT at 3 time points. One before anything happened, one after a second imaging session after 1 week of the drug, and a third session 1 week after radiation started. And these are some of the pictures in 2 patients. So if you look at the top here, there's the cervical tumor. This is after 1 week of the drug alone, and you see this central hypodensity and this enhancement around the rim here. These are snapshots from a DCEMR sequence late in the time course. So these show the late phase enhancement characteristics. But the tumor hasn't started to shrink in any way at this point. There are certainly changes, you would think, in the vasculature, and I would say looking at that there's been a change in blood flow and or permeability, a reduction in both. By this point, 1 week into treatment or so, it's actually 2 weeks, I guess, things have started to shrink a little bit. Whereas this tumor, there was no response whatsoever, as far as you can tell just by looking at it. And when we looked across the board at these patients, there actually were some interesting findings. First of all, the tumor volume increased slightly. Just look at this metric here. This is the K-trans that was derived from DCEMR. it dropped by 50% after 1 week of treatment, again, consistent with changes in perfusion or permeability. That was a significant change. But what happened in this tumor is they got more hypoxic. At least the median PO2 fell from 14 millimeters of mercury to about 3, and this was measured with a needle electrode technique that we used where we made direct measurements in the tumor. So the whole story kind of came together in a way that suggested that the effects of these anti-angiogenic treatments were not going to be beneficial for us, that they were actually making things worse perhaps in these tumors, and that study went no further. But it does actually illustrate that having a baseline measurement here in an individual patient that you can actually compare to later on actually may be important in these types of studies. Now, in the last few minutes, and I haven't got much time left, I want to just talk a little bit about oxygen and measuring oxygen using similar techniques in tumors. We measured oxygen, and we have for many years in our patients with cervix cancer and prostate cancer, for that matter, using an electrode technique that gives us a direct measurement. But we need better ways. We need more usable ways for patients. We need more reproducible techniques that could be used in the context of a clinical trial, for example. And from an imaging perspective, there's a couple of ways that are being investigated. There's probably more than this, but these are the ones that probably are furthest advanced in the clinic. The first is using an MR technique called blood oxygen level dependent imaging, in which deoxygenated hemoglobin in the tumor acts as an inherent or intrinsic contrast medium for MR. I'm not going to talk about that today, but what I am going to talk about is the use of positron emission tomography. And the reason I focus on that is that some of the modeling techniques that are being developed for PET imaging of hypoxia link back to the DCEMR techniques that people are working on. So there's a sort of a continuum or a continuity there that I think we might be able to explore in more detail in relation to both the vasculature and hypoxia. So for those of you who don't know about PET, I have one little picture. PET imaging, positron emission tomography, is based on a tracer of interest, say hypoxia tracer. It's something that binds in hypoxic areas of a tumor, linked to a molecule that's a positron emitter, and that's usually a fluorine molecule, 18 F, that is bound to whatever this tracer may be. Once injected into the body, that tracer undergoes positron decay, and these positrons travel a distance of 1 or 2 millimeters in tissue, then they then meet up with an electron, and they are annihilated, and at that process of annihilation actually releases 2 gamma rays that can be picked up by a series of detectors. So what this allows you to do then is localize areas of hypoxia within a volume of interest, spatially within a volume of interest in a tumor or in a patient, for example. And there are a bunch of PET imaging agents for hypoxia. Most of these are nitroimidazole compounds. It's a chemical structure that these agents are taken up and bound in hypoxic areas of tumors, so they're fixed there and bound really in an irreversible manner for all intents and purposes. And as they undergo positron decay, you can actually image the location of these things within tumors. So you, in theory, get a measure of hypoxia that can be localized to a tumor. And there are a bunch of these have been around. The 18F misonidazole has probably been most extensively studied. We're currently using 18F FASA. And the difference among these is actually relating to a number of factors here. The lipophilicity, so how they're taken up in cells and different tissues of the body, their biologic half-life, their radiologic half-life, and that positron range in tissue. And all of these factors can influence the tissue-to-background ratio that you're seeing and signal intensity and image resolution. And so this technique has many advantages. It is minimally invasive. It gives an indication of hypoxia within tumors. It's broadly applicable. It assesses the entire tumor volume, and you can do it serially over time in patients, so you can see how hypoxia is changing over time. But there's a few challenges. It has a limited spatial resolution because of the finite positron range of 1 or 2 millimeters. So normally when you do PET imaging, you fuse the biologic PET study with a CAT scan image in order to link. So you get the anatomic resolution from the CT, you get the biologic information from the PET. And that's what's happened here. These are two of our patients with cervix cancer where you can see the sort of color wash, the reddish stuff is from the PET study, and the anatomic information in grayscale is from the CT. This is a patient where her tumor is situated here, and you really don't see much in the way of uptake from FASA in that tumor, but you see a lot of uptake in her bladder. This is another patient where you see much more uptake in the central region of her tumor, and again, uptake in her bladder. So this uptake in normal tissues is a problem that we're struggling with, because it's not so evident in some of these images, but you get a sort of a washout around the area of tumor that you're concerned about from the bladder into the tumor, which can influence your interpretation of the tumor numbers. Bladder uptake of these agents is actually very, very intense. It's cleared, the agents are cleared through the bladder, so you get a lot of accumulation in the bladder, and sometimes in bowel, liver, other structures within the body. Tumor uptake of these things is not so intense. It's passively transported into cancer cells. It's not actively transported into cancer cells, so you get very little enhancement sometimes in tumors, and so you have this, and that's the area you're interested in, of course, sitting right against an area of very intense signal intensity. So separating those two and actually interpreting the results in a meaningful way is a challenge, and we have some of our students and physicists working on ways of looking at these imaging sets and separating the signal from the bladder and the washout effect from the bladder into the tumor from what's really going on in the tumor. It's another area where I think modeling can have a huge impact on how we interpret some of these scans. The other thing is that we're looking at various dynamics here that are quite complex. If you think about it, there is, for each of these agents, once there's injected, there's a pharmacokinetic half-life, so how quickly is that thing cleared from the circulation and from the tumor and from the tissues in the body, purely through the kidneys and bladder, for example. There is a radiological half-life, so that thing's undergoing to go radiological decay, positron decay, so the signal you're going to be able to detect is diminishing over time, because that's what you're using to get a signal, a measurement from. And then you're also, there are a set of dynamics associated with the binding of these nitroimidazole compounds in the tumor itself. So when we come to analyze all of this, we're actually struggling with how do we trade off all of these different dynamics in relation to the optimal imaging time point, for example. If you image too soon, you may have a lot of drug or tracer within the tumor that is still floating around in the vasculature and the interstitium, but isn't necessarily bound in hypoxic areas. What we want, if we're imaging hypoxia, is just the fraction that's bound in the hypoxic area of the tumor. So if we image too early, we get a false signal because there's more stuff in there that doesn't reflect hypoxia. If we image too late, we've lost signal because it's decayed radiologically, radiological decay. So this is where there's a lot of interest going on. This is one of the studies that Sean Stapleton and Naz Chaudhuri have done, looking at FASA in some of our preclinical models of cervix cancer. So this is a cervical cancer growing in the cervix of a mouse right here. These tumors are actually tumors that were derived from our patient population directly, so in conjunction with Dick's lab. So they actually, we hope, reflect more accurately the underlying biology of the patient population than a tumor that's been propagated over time in animals. These are primary xenografts. And this is FASA imaging of that tumor, and what Sean did here was simply look at the 1 or 2 hour time point threshold on muscle, 2 standard deviations above muscle, and then look to see what proportion of that tumor volume was above that, and as a measure of hypoxic fraction or hypoxic volume. And we did that in a bunch of different tumors, and you can see that there are hypoxic fractions that range from, I guess the lowest here is about 44% up to, what's the highest, 84% or 87%. So it does suggest that there's a range of hypoxic volumes within these tumors. The problem with this kind of technique is what I said before. How do you know 2 hours is the right time point? What if you've done it at 1 hour? What if you've done it at 2 hours? How do you know that what you're actually measuring is the bound FASA in hypoxic regions of the tumor and not stuff that's still floating around the blood vessels or whatever? And so people have actually looked at various dynamic models, very similar dynamic models to what we've talked about for DCE analysis to try to get at this. And you can think of a couple of, there are different ways of putting this together. With the DCE, people think of a vascular compartment and an interstitial compartment. These models have tended to think about a vascular compartment, a diffusive compartment, in other words, the contrast tracer, the radiological tracer diffuses from the vascular department into some aspect of the tumor itself. But then there's another element to this, which is an accumulated or bound compartment where where tracer, once in the diffusive compartment, will bind and remain there over time. So the concept would be that over time you'd get a peak here, a peak here. This would slowly increase over time, but eventually the diffusive compartments and the vascular compartments would disappear in tumors, and what you'd be left with would be the accumulated compartment. And you can link, you can put together a series of differential equations that describe this, and you can use those differential equations to actually define an equation that links what you're measuring in terms of signal intensity to this model. And basically, there are three weighting factors that come out of this. There's a weighting factor that reflects the proportion of the signal that's coming from the vascular department, the proportion that's coming from the diffusive compartment, and the proportion that's coming from the accumulated or bound compartment. And what we want to know is this, because that should best reflect hypoxia within these tumors. And this group has done a really nice job of looking at this in a series of head and neck cancer patients. And if you look at this plot here, these are, first of all, we'll start here. So these are time activity curves for different voxels within an imaging volume of interest, and they have different shapes associated with them. And what you can see is that there's different uptakes initially. Some of them, like this one, there's very minimal uptake. This one, it's actually very high. And this initial uptake is thought to reflect perfusion. So this reflects how quickly you're getting a signal in that tumor, which really reflects blood flow into the tumor at early times after injection of the contrast agent. So this early rise, the degree of rise here, gives you some indication of blood flow in those tumors. Then if you look at longer times in the shapes of these curves, you get an indication perhaps of hypoxia, and you can actually use the model that I described earlier, showed just a minute ago, to calculate that weighting factor associated with accumulation of contrast agent or tracer in the tumor. And that's essentially what they've plotted along this axis here. So along the x-axis is the accumulation factor, the weighting factor associated with accumulation of tracer in the tumor. And along this axis, the y-axis, they've plotted some measure of perfusion derived from this early inflow. And you can see they've been able to break down the pixels in this tumor into several different categories. There's those where there's rapid or high blood flow, but what would appear to be very little hypoxia, which is good. There's a group of patients, on the other hand, where blood flow is actually quite low and they appear quite hypoxic. And then there's a group in the middle where there are perfusion and hypoxia-related defects. So it's this kind of modeling, I think, and this, I think, is just a very early attempt or a first attempt to do this kind of work, but it's these kinds of models that allow us to get useful information about what's going on. And it would be really interesting to take this patient, for example. You could envision doing this up front and then re-imaging this patient after giving them a treatment that specifically targets hypoxia within the tumor or targets angiogenesis, for example, and looking at the kind of distribution that you see here. So those are the kinds of things that we're struggling with right now. How do we, in a reproducible way in patients, minimally invasive way, actually image things that we think are relevant to outcome and track those changes over time? It kind of gives you a flavor of the sort of thinking that's going on in the community right now, and I hope gives you some idea or gives you some thoughts about maybe where opportunities are for moving forward. And I think there are opportunities for developing newer and better models. Now, these have to be done with an understanding of the underlying biology, and they also have to be done with a good understanding of the dynamics of the imaging modality that you're using and the limitations of that imaging modality. But I think integrating all of this together with smart people like you driving it, I think actually has huge potential for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. It's clear that, I guess, that the vascular chain is sort of, I mean, we can extrapolate easily, and there's no problem.
So the high molecular weight agents are actually quite interesting because they tend to stay in. They first of all, they have long intravascular half-lives. The low molecular weight agents, it's a matter of minutes, and they're out of the vasculature very quickly. Whereas the high molecular weight, the liposomal and these are basically liposomes that contain gadolinium, the same contrast agent inside the liposome, and they have long intravascular half-lives on the order of days. So the tumor is constantly exposed to this. All of the tissues in the body are constantly exposed to this over time. And we believe that those agents will tend to move from the vasculature into the interstitium and through the interstitium by convection, because they're so large that that movement along a concentration gradient just is take years, months to actually accomplish anything. So we believe that they're driven by convection. And what you see over time in terms of tumor enhancement over the course of days is an enhancement pattern within tumors that's driven by these convective gradients. And as I kind of alluded to earlier, one of the intriguing issues is that the convective gradients in tumors, the hydrostatic gradients, are not the same as in most normal tissues because of high interstitial fluid pressure. So the pressure in many of these tumors in the interstitium of the tumor is very close to the vascular pressure. So there's not a strong gradient or not as big a gradient driving these things out of the vasculature, at least in the center of the tumor. And then the pressure in the tumor is quite uniform in the interstitium of the tumor, so they don't tend to move through the tumor in any rapid manner. And what we tend to see is an enhancement pattern around the periphery of the tumor, at the edge of the tumor where the IFP is lower. And so it's actually telling us something about convective gradients. It's also, we think, perhaps going to tell us something about IFP distribution and IFP in these tumors. So I'll I'm going to let Dick talk about stem cells because that's but yes, they probably do change. There are some studies, and we know that hypoxia is very dynamic. You know, in very simple terms, there's a component of hypoxia that we call chronic hypoxia that in many ways is limited by, for example, diffusion distances in tumors and the irregular vasculature. And there may be an element that's fairly constant in tumors, but superimposed on that is a more dynamic element of hypoxia that can vary over varying time frames, sometimes over the course of minutes, sometimes over days. So we know that that changes, and it's one of the areas that's challenging if you start thinking about this. I mentioned at the start of the talk about people thinking about dose escalation to to radioresistant regions of tumors, and if you for a minute assume that hypoxia hypoxic regions are going to be radioresistant, you could actually dose escalate to those areas, give higher radiation doses, but we don't know very well the dynamics of how oxygenation and hypoxia is going to change. So if you plan something for today and plan to dose escalate in that area of a tumor, tomorrow it could be quite different. So you have to image repeatedly. And I'll let Dick talk about the stem cell, answer the stem cell question for you.
So we heard about that yesterday, right? About the possibility that hypoxia actually modifies gene expression and the
this one? Yeah. These are this is a pixel based analysis of the imaging. So they've broken it down into pixels and then analyzed each pixel separately, and so you get a map of the distribution of these things. The other way to do it is to take the whole volume together and analyze it together. So I'd have to look back at that paper, but it's going to be on the order of millimeters. It's not going to be less than that, just because of the finite, you know, you have a range of 1 or 2 millimeters with these positron images. So it's on the order of millimeters, you know, in a volume of, yeah. Yeah.
I remember ages ago you showed us some of the images of pinching and some of the vessels within, you know, with, so the IFP is actually now about
We don't. So IFP is sort of an integrative function. So it gives you an average. The pressure in the tumor that you would measure is an average measure. It reflects the average microvascular pressure is probably the best way to say it, right? So within that, any particular tumor, you're going to have some vessels that have higher pressures and some lower. So you can get, even though that convective transport will reduce, you will get some movement across those gradients. The models, of course, that don't account for that heterogeneity assume it's zero in the center of tumors, but it's not probably.
About the issue of convection, we had a talk yesterday about the effect of dynamic stress on the structure of collagen and the implication being this might relate to maybe stromal components in tumors and things, and the concept that in fact dynamic stress induced by the tumor cell populations in fact can actually change the structure of collagen, maybe actually kind of linearize it in a sense. So the question would be whether we really know what is actually impacting on convection and whether this is just diffusion between the cells or is it really diffusion through the stromal component?
I think it. So the convection, so that would speak to sort of the resistance that the interstitium and the cellular compartment together offer to convection or diffusion for that matter, right? If it changed,
might actually be not just kind of diffusing everywhere, it might be flowing everywhere, it might be quite specific.
It could also change, yes, it depends on, so from convection, you also need pressure gradients to drive it, right? So it doesn't matter what else is going on, if you've got no pressure gradient, in theory, you won't get convective flow. But what you're saying could actually influence the distribution at some level of IFP within a tumor, for example, right? If you're getting changes in the collagen structure and the interstitial transport characteristics for fluid through that tumor, you actually could get varying convective gradients as a result of that, I would have thought. It could also influence diffusion. You know, although these things don't move much by diffusion, you know, if the resistance or the diffusion coefficient could change in some way as a result of these kinds of effects, I would have thought.
So one of the patients, you showed two patients, one had some response, the other one said, well, there was no tumor shrinkage, so by that measure, there was a response. So are you generally satisfied with that kind of assessment that tumor shrinkage is actually the dominant method for assessing a response
So there's no doubt that in the medical community, change in tumor size is the dominant metric for any kind of clinical trial because nobody knows really what to do on a consistent basis. So there are things called RESIST criteria, which I'm sure everyone's heard about, which really say in the context of a study, if you image now and image later, if this thing changes in volume by this amount, that's a partial response. If it completely disappears, that's a complete response. So most clinical trials these days are based on RESIST criteria. But that's not the most appropriate way of looking at these kinds of things. And what I think, what I was kind of showing in that image was that there's no change in size in that first tumor after 1 week of the drug, yet there were apparent changes in something in the imaging that we were seeing, right, that would be consistent with reduced permeability or flow or something in that tumor. So the point of that was that we didn't actually see any change in size until the radiation started, but we had seen a change with the drug alone that would have been ignored otherwise. And the second patient on the bottom, I just put that one there because it didn't actually illustrate the same kinds of changes after even 1 week of the drug alone. And that was to point out that there is heterogeneity from one patient to the next, that we need to think of them as individuals. Yeah. And that's right. Particularly in relation to some of these new imaging, the new drugs that we're using. And one of those papers that I showed when I was talking about standardization actually spoke specifically to the use of DCEMR as a measure that using RESIST alone is not the way to go if you're looking at some of these biologically targeted strategies that you need to look at biologic endpoints as well.
Yeah.
Thank you.